Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. A strange thing. I won't reveal who I am or much about where I live. And to be honest, it's been a few months since this happened. But I just came to terms with it now. And I have to warn people about what's out there. What they knew, what we don't. Occasionally, I like to go hiking with my friends. There's not much more to do, honestly. We live in a small mountain town in Colorado. It was fun at first, but by now, we know the trails by heart. By the end of last summer, there was only one we hadn't tried. Now, there's a reason for that. The trail goes right through a portion of the forest that the Ute people considered sacred. I'll admit, I have hang-ups when it comes to these things. You don't wear hats in a church. You don't let the American flag touch the ground. You don't trudge all over somebody's sacred land for the fun of it. Still, my friend, we'll call him Mark, convinced me to go. He said that regardless of whether I went, he'd go anyway. And since no one else was going, he managed to goad me into going with him. That's another one of my hang-ups. Don't go hiking alone. Don't let friends go hiking alone. Too many tragic news stories start that way. So I ended up going with him, reluctantly. The whole way there he was talking about how this was the coolest trail he'd ever been on. Yes, he had been there before, though only once. His manipulative ploy had been to get me to come with him so that he could show me. He admitted this all in the casual way that friends admit being asses to friends. Sometimes I didn't blame him. I had a tendency to have a stick up my butt, and what followed only reinforced it. We arrived at about 9. I remember giving us plenty of time. It was further away from town than most trails, and it wasn't near a paved road, so there was a lot of walking just to get there. No tourists knew about it. A lot of locals and even some Ute didn't know about it. But if you followed a game trail through a bunch of trees, it would widen out and lead its way through some mountainous, densely forested terrain. What struck me was how quiet it was. This apparently was what Mark had found so awesome. For some reason, in this particular place, you couldn't hear any birds chirping or any wildlife whatsoever. It was complete and utter silence. Eventually, I had to urinate. I stepped off the main road, just so Mark wouldn't see me. As I was going on, I spotted something through the trees. It looked like some sort of clearing, just past a shallow creek with a log going over it. My curiosity got the better of me as I looked at the log. It didn't seem to be an act of nature. It was a makeshift bridge, I was sure. True enough, when I tested it, it seemed to be stable. I put one foot in front of the other and crossed. When I reached the other end, I pulled my way through some trees and saw the first image of the day that I will never forget, though to many, it wouldn't have seemed like much. In front of me, there was vegetation, trees, ferns, and brush, but suddenly it all stopped. Within a perfect circle, surrounded by small, perfectly arranged rocks, there was nothing but smooth dirt. It was strange, not in the least because the shape of the rocks was absolutely perfect. They were partially submerged in the soil and fit together like bricks. Every single one of them was the same uniform white color. And as I got closer, I saw things had been carved on them, symbols. They were old, very old. Even if I had understood them, since their distinct shapes had been lost over their years. That was strange. But what disturbed me was that this circle wasn't actually perfect. On one edge, just one, a group of rocks had been kicked up. They were scattered around as if they actually had been a perfect brick wall, and something had shattered them. In this area, the otherwise perfectly smooth dirt had been kicked up. There was something about it that just unsettled me. As quiet as the entire forest was, it felt quieter here. I quickly turned around and went back to Mark, who made some lame number two joke. I should have forced him to leave right there. Instead, though, we kept going. After all, the day was only halfway over. While the forest itself was cool, at least from Mark's perspective, I found the trail to be rather disappointing. It just went on and on. There were no alternate paths, and there was hardly any challenging terrain. For Colorado, this whole area was so flat, it was hardly a hike at all. The trail was just long, very long. It took us until noon to reach the end, and there was no one else on it. I know that it was a hard trail to find, and many of the other locals might share my sentiments, but we were there all day, and we didn't run into anyone. Of course, it wasn't until we reached the end that things started getting really weird. The trail didn't loop at all, and I inwardly groaned knowing that we'd be walking these three same boring hours back. We took our time eating lunch. As we did, I could swear I heard noises for the first time. There were animals moving through the forest nearby. We could hear the rustling of the brush. I looked and saw through the foliage the vague outline of a single buck's head moving past us. It was odd, but I dismissed it. We packed up what was left of our lunches and started the trek back. Every once in a while, I would hear the rustling again. I'd look into the trees, and oftentimes, I would see the buck's head. Eventually, though, I noticed that it was making far too much noise and was doing it too frequently. I told Mark to slow down and stop, and being Mark, he cracked a joke about it. But finally, he went silent, and we both still heard the rustling. Now, even Mark was a little freaked out. He turned back and saw the vaguest outline of the buck's head again. This time, to me, there seemed to be something wrong. The head was far too high up, around the higher branches of the trees. I noticed it. Mark didn't. I should have said something, but I didn't have time. Just as soon as it was there, it was gone again, going off further into the forest. I remember Mark talking about how deer were annoying as hell, about how he was going to scare it off or something. I don't remember exactly what he said, and that bothers me because I should remember. He was one of my best friends. I do remember him yelling at it, and at the same time it was funny. "Hey, Buck, yeah, you horny motherfucker, leave us alone." He walked off the road and disappeared down the ridge behind the layer of trees, pursuing it. For a minute, there was silence. That minute became two. "Mark," I called out. No answer. 5 minutes passed. I climbed down the ridge after him. "Mark?" I followed the general direction he had gone in, keeping the way back to the road in mind. I wouldn't go far. I knew because he was smart enough not to go far. He hadn't. After a short time, I found a place where there were signs of a struggle. In addition, there was blood. There was a lot of blood. It was all over the trees and the ground. I cursed myself. There were other things, too, in addition to the blood. Pieces of flesh that I didn't like to look at. There were marks showing that something had been dragged away from there. "Mark," I called out furiously now. Forgetting the trail for a second, I ran forward along the drag marks. After running too far to be safe, I reached a small ravine with a creek running through it. I narrowly stopped myself. It wasn't a long drop, but it hurt you, and a sprained ankle in the middle of the forest was bad news. The trail stopped here. "Mark," I murmured, then called out again. "Mark!" Something heard, but it wasn't Mark. Across the ravine from me, I heard a rustling and saw the tree stirring. Something stepped through the foliage and revealed itself. This was the second image burned into my mind. "Please, give me a second. I've spent every day for the past few months trying to tell myself this wasn't real." At first, I saw a head, the head of a buck. But it came forward, and I realized that it was 7 feet above the ground. I was staring at a 7-foot creature straight in the face that had a massive buck's head, but a humanoid body. The creature snorted. Its buck face remained neutral, scared looking, even as if it wasn't sure of the malicious whims of the body beneath it. There was blood dripping from its horns, which were not at all like the horns of the average buck, but jagged, pointed, and unorganized, a mess of sharp, bloody points. Its human body was dark-skinned and naked, with very human genitalia. Its penis was dripping blood, just like its horns, implying things that I don't want to think of. I remember both its arms and its legs. They started human, but near the bottom, they started to distort and become animalistic, At the end of its legs were powerful hooves. At the end of its arms were hands with long claws, every bit as jagged as the horns on its head. And one of those jaws, Mark's body was being held by his shirt. I examined him only briefly, just long enough to notice that the shape of his head was not what it had once been. For a moment, there was silence. I didn't scream. I couldn't believe what was in front of me. Then the creature's ears ruffled. It dropped Mark's body apathetically and started backing up. Its deer head hung lazily to the side as it moved. My brain rang. Suddenly, it's going to jump the gap. It's coming for me. With the logical side of my mind shut off, I turned around and ran, hopefully in the exact opposite direction of the way I had come. Behind me, I heard a powerful grunt, and then a scuffle of the monster landing on the bank. There was a horrifying roar, something that sounded like a buck and a grizzly bear shouting together. I'd never run so fast or so desperately in all my life, but it was gaining on me. As I ran through the forest, I started to feel its warm, hungry breath on my back. Its hands were extending, and I swear I could feel one of its claws scratch me. I ran and scurried up the bank leading to the path. I don't know how I got there without it grabbing me, but I did. Then I took off down the road, hoping that I was going in the right direction. While running, I threw off my backpack and gained some speed. I think the bank delayed it, slightly. That's the only reason I can account as to how I may have gotten ahead of it. Somehow, I ran and ran and ran. I didn't stop. Eventually, I didn't hear it anymore, but I didn't care. I kept running. I had never been a long-distance runner, but my adrenaline was not going to wear off anytime soon, and I intended to take advantage of it. When I reached the end of the trail and saw the road again, I couldn't believe it. I got into my car. Just before I took off, I shot a glance back up the trail at the point where it went up between two mountains and was visible from the road. I would regret it. Standing there near the beginning of the trail was a skinwalker, as I've come to call it. It had given up its chase, but it stood there watching me hungrily, waiting to see if I would come back. Its deer head hung lazily and dead to the side. The blood on its body was beginning to dry. It had run the whole trail, and it didn't look tired at all. I twisted the ignition, floored the car, and never came back. They never found Mark, and I would never explain what happened. No one would believe me, though I needed to tell someone, which is why I'm saying this story. It comes back to me in my dreams, nightmares. That creature, the skinwalker. Somehow, I thought that force was really sacred. In fact, I'm sure it was the opposite. Because the image that flashes through my mind most often is not the horrific creature. It isn't Mark's raped and mutilated corpse. It's that circle, which must have been maintained over the years by those who knew, those who understood. That old circle left alone for so long that had been quietly penetrated. The Ark. I recently came across a journal in my grandfather's attic. It involves a journey to locate the actual Noah's Ark of all things. He was an assistant to Jonathan Davis, the professor of biblical history at a university that isn't mentioned in the journal. My grandfather passed away last year from dementia, so I don't see a problem with relating some of the entries. June 1st, 1951. Our travels have concluded, and we have at last arrived at the mountain of Ararat. We first stopped at a drogstone said to be dropped from the ark as the waters receded. Now it sits in the middle of the vast valley underneath Mount Ararat. Pilgrims had marked the drogstone with crosses. This seemed rather odd, as this did not represent Noah or God's covenant. We made camp in the vans, had a dinner of pasta, and went to sleep. I will begin my detailed entries in the days to come, as I hope they will bring prosperous results. June 2, 1951. Today we made our way to the Drupanar site. Our guide informed us that recent tests had proven it was indeed merely a geological formation caused by an earthquake. It is merely a series of ridges rising from the ground the shape of a boat. Our test concluded that it was earth, not petrified wood, as it should be if it were indeed the ark. I did find it curious, though, that not more than half a kilometer away, stood the ruins of an ancient monastery. Noah did build an altar after he exited the ark, and in my mind I imagined this was it, and I stood at it all those years ago, observing Noah and his family during worship after God had delivered them from disaster. We had discussed earlier in the year of trekking all the way to the location of the Ararat anomaly. It is a formation seen from spy planes photographs, revealing a formation bearing a striking resemblance to a very large boat. I, along with the others, knew this formation would no longer remain, as the glaciers would have carried away. It, like Dhir Pinnar, was most likely nothing more than an interesting geological formation. Those who had tried to locate it failed miserably, and we would try to search other plateaus on Ararat that seemed like a natural spot for the Ark to rest. Tomorrow we start the search. I'm quite excited at the adventure that awaits. June 4th, 1951. We have made great progress. The cold has sunk into us, but we remain in high spirits. We are headed towards God's plateau, as Taylor calls it, as he believes that God would have wanted us to rest the Ark there. It would provide an easy trek down Ararat for Noah and his family, as well as the animals. Most importantly, we made our greatest discovery yet, a fossilized bird of great size, resembling a small ostrich. Such a bird has no business this high on Ararat, and thus has great implications. Our excitement at this find has put faith in the more doubtful among us. Most biblical scholars doubt the story of Noah, and even if we fail to locate the ark, this find will sway many in opinion. Carl is pestering us to stop and allow him to dig for more remains, but Jonathan remains vigilant that we must proceed with haste. He is growing more worried by the day that the Turkish authorities will revoke our permits, and at worst imprison us if we fall behind our schedule. We should reach God's plateau tomorrow. Until then. June 5th, 1951. Today has been filled with disappointment. God's plateau has been visited by another group before. We found a derelict camp there, two broken tents. But most strange was that all the group supplies still remained. Food cans, sleeping bags, and clothes were scattered about. This must have been mere weeks or less before we arrived, because this high on Ararat storms are known to come at a moment's notice. We found nothing. Jonathan and Carl's groups excavated with furious intensity for caves or more fossils. Nothing has been found. We expect to continue in the coming days, but there seems to be a strong distaste in the air. All are irritable. Davis even wants to leave tomorrow, though I know he won't as long as Jonathan remains. We still have 2 weeks remaining to investigate Ararat, but even I have the feeling that the mountain wants us to leave. It is quite strange, yes, but the feeling is inescapable. I will retire. I feel the cold seeping into me. June 6, 1951. Everyone is sick. Carl and his team attempted to trek to the far side of God's plateau to scout for caves or ruins, but there is a growing wind, and most of Carl's team is stricken by headaches and nausea. Jonathan worked furiously at his map for the day while the team slept. There was no progress, and feelings of terror are sinking into all of us for reasons unknown. We are in no immediate danger, thankfully. Weather reports are clear other than icy cold winds that are coming at this altitude. I am fatigued. Hopefully by tomorrow the team will have renewed strength. June 7th, 1951. So much to say. I'll start at the beginning. During the early morning hours, there was an avalanche. It felt like the earth was collapsing and the whole team, even Jonathan, began to scream in terror. After we realized that we were spared from the avalanche's wrath, we came to a horrifying realization. 8 were missing, including Carl. They had seemingly vanished without a trace. Upon examination, we saw that their clothing was still inside their tents. It was as if they had woken in the night and just walked away, not dressing in their coats, but just walking off into the mountain. The mountain has, by the only way I can describe it, been growling all day. It is a low rumble, most like that of a mountain lion, as it has spotted its prey. We felt it throughout the day as we traveled. It only stopped later. We couldn't stay on God's plateau. We just knew we had to leave. Jonathan presumed that the others had left, packed up and just walked back down the mountain. They wouldn't have survived, I knew. It was too cold, and they were not dressed. Jonathan didn't bother with this. There was a certain confusion in the air, whether it was caused by paranoia or the growling of the mountain, I do not know. We packed the camp and pressed onwards. We didn't get far as the avalanche uncovered Noah's Ark. We found it. I still don't believe it. It was too easy. All worry was washed away. First we saw what looked like a man-made formation. It is a curve, the top. What was uncovered is a small portion, about 30 feet of the top of the Ark. At that point, we were too flabbergasted to even move. As we saw it, it was as if Christ himself had come down to play poker with us. It was just unbelievable. We knew it was larger than it appeared because on the left side it stopped, and there was the structure itself, only protruding 5 feet or so underneath the section of the roof. We saw that it wasn't stone. It was petrified wood. Jonathan ran to it and caressed the structure. What is immediately visible is 30 feet of the top of the Ark coming out of the snow. It is most certainly buried. At the left where the roof stops is what must be the front or back. All of us worked the rest of that day at uncovering the portion of the Ark, and we have succeeded. We dug out about 15 feet of snow for 50 feet and discovered the portion uncovered was the side of the Ark. There is only one way in and out of the Ark. It is doubtful it is still there, so we must breach the side tomorrow. The excitement is immense. We only stopped to dig out of pure exhaustion. I just noticed that the growl of the mountain has stopped. I don't know when it happened. I guess the excitement of the day distracted me. It is nearly 2 in the morning, and tomorrow we will uncover the greatest archaeological discovery in the history of mankind. June 8, 1951. I don't have the words to express the terror that transpired over the last 2 days. The team is all dead, save for me and Jonathan. I will write what has happened and then burn this journal. What is inside the Ark is not meant to be uncovered. I learned it's too late. We had an opportunity to turn back, several in fact. We awoke to a scream, a woman's scream. It came from just outside our tent, and upon searching the area surrounding the tents, the team found nothing. Jonathan dismissed it as the wind playing with us, but I still had some trepidation regarding it, as the wind had all but stopped. We were all awake, so we took up trying to bore a hole into the Ark. We had dynamite, but it seemed wrong to use explosives on Noah's Ark. But looking back, I wish that we had used everything we had to erase it from the face of the earth. It took all of 20 minutes before we were through the petrified wood. Jonathan was first inside. He became silent. I followed next. It was silent. We were the first inside the Ark since Noah had left it all those millennia ago. It was a solemn moment, not soon to be replaced with terror. The team followed. It was a long hallway of collapsed rooms. The floor was gone in places, revealing the cavernous space below. Time had not been kind to the Ark. I was surprised that the glaciers and snow had not eroded the Ark away. I felt then that we were not alone, but being watched by the eyes of time itself, or something more sinister. We traveled deeper, Jonathan first, followed by me and the 12 others on the team. I thought I could hear breathing. Not the breathing of the team's racing lungs, but something else. Guttural is how I perceived it. This brought my mind to the fallen angels that had caused the flood. In Genesis it says that God's fallen angels in the time before the flood had come to earth and married its women. God saw this and was disgusted, prompting him to command Noah to build the structure we were now standing in. All living things on earth were killed by God, and we were standing in their would-be salvation. Noah had tried to warn them, but they didn't listen. I can't imagine what they felt when it started to rain. Then I saw it, by my torchlight, a ram. It stood in the path ahead, perfectly alive. The team saw this too and froze. It merely stood and watched, then turned and walked away, like we were nothing. No one spoke for a time. Then, like a bat out of hell, we heard Carl. Carl had disappeared from us before we found the Ark, and he sounded like he was dead. He called John. He didn't sound far, but he was muffled a bit. I took a step back. It was like a bad dream had come true. Jonathan took a step forward. As we drew near a collapsed bit of floor, we realized he was down in the darkness below, where the ram must have gone. None of it made sense. It still doesn't as I write it. But we slowly drew near as Carl sounded like he was fading deeper into the arc. That is when we heard the steps. From behind the team came a thunderous sound of a stampede. Chaos ensued that I can't make much light of. We all sprinted into the dark of the floor below us. I dropped my torch, and after about 15 feet, I tripped and fell onto the petrified floor. I stayed still and listened to what was happening. It was pitch black as Jonathan and I were the only ones who had torches. Jonathan was nowhere. There was the screams of the team, the grunts of animals. I don't understand how this could have been. Then the screams were silenced one by one. They sounded like they were being ripped apart and eaten. I was petrified, and I waited and waited. I don't know how long until the chaos subsided, but when it did, I wanted to run, run, and run. I wanted to be far. I wished I had never come. I crawled towards the faint torchlight above, but stopped as I heard steps in front of me. By the torchlight, I watched a man with the head of the ram step into the darkness where the floor had been eroded away into the darkness below. I know this must not have been real. The horror that had transpired must have left me crazy, but I pressed on. I picked up my torch, and in the hallway, I saw Thomas, an assistant of Carl's, laying torn apart. His face had been ripped off. He was missing both of his legs, and his chest was crushed. Thomas turned what was left of his head towards me. His eyes were gone, but I felt he was looking directly at me. I knew it. I almost was driven insane by this stare, but I stepped over him and exited the ark. Jonathan was outside on his knees. His gaze was blank, and he was limp. All that mattered was getting to safety. I didn't worry about the rest of the team. I just needed to be away. I'm still convinced this is all a dream. Perhaps my sanity has left me. Perhaps I am dead, and this is my purgatory. I dragged Jonathan to his feet, and somehow to the vans all the way below. I do not remember most of the trek down. I must not have much sanity left. I don't know what happened. I'm afraid I will sleep tonight, and awake to find the man with a ram's head at the foot of my bed, awaiting me. I don't know how I was able to leave without the forces in the ark capturing me. I don't know how I made it down the mountain. I don't know anything anymore. I don't know what it was that attacked the team. The way I have put it together in my mind is that these are the souls and demons that the flood wiped out. They come there seeking refuge from a disaster that has already taken them. This is the only way I can make sense of any of it. I don't know why they are hostile. Noah's Ark is meant to be left. It should have been lost with the winds of time. I regret leaving it open for the horrors to escape into the world. I am done. I'm rambling. I don't know what I am to do anymore. No place like the basement. I just sent a voice message to my former landlord asking if my old place was still available. I cannot stand the new place I have been renting. I greatly appreciate my new landlord for allowing me to break the lease, but I'm still pissed at him for using me as a guinea pig. 2 months ago, my boss decided to quit for health reasons. I was one half of the company's budgeting team. She handled all the political battles while I crunched all the numbers on spreadsheets. We were the perfect team. However, other people in the office saw it differently. They saw me do all the heavy lifting while she rode on my coattails. This was completely untrue, as we wouldn't have gotten as far as we did if it wasn't for her support. Since budgeting season was about to start, they offered me her position. Everybody knew I was next in line for the position anyway. Hiring someone else to fill a position would be counterproductive since I'd be the one training my would-be boss. So I decided to accept the promotion. Even though I'll be logging more unpaid overtime hours over the next few months, I will be getting a big boost in salary, plus a decent year-end bonus if budgeting goes smoothly. I've already gone through 5 budgeting cycles with the company, so I know what to expect. I'm more excited about getting the extra money than being intimidated about the extra workload and responsibility. The timing is perfect, as I have been thinking about moving to a nicer part of town closer to the beach. So I spent the next couple of weeks on Craigslist looking up places to rent. Land is expensive where I live, and the rental vacancy rate is extremely low. Even though I've gotten more spending money now, I'm still a Scrooge at heart. So I took my time in looking for the perfect place at the right price. To my surprise, I stumbled upon an ad for a rental suite in the perfect area available immediately, but at a rather cheap rate. However, I had a weird feeling about this one because why rent below the market rate? Not wanting to pass on this opportunity, I jumped on the phone. After a brief chat with the landlord, I made arrangements to sign a 6-month lease and to give the security deposit. I can't remember the last time I was this excited about anything. Move-in day is the first time I actually got to see the place in person. I'll be staying in a 2-bedroom, 975-square-foot basement suite of a huge 2-story bungalow. The house itself was built in the 1920s, but had been recently renovated. The landlord was planning on moving to the top floor sometime in the future. The basement suite looks exactly like it did in the pictures on Craigslist. However, there was something strange about the layout of this house. First of all, the basement suite is mostly below ground, and none of the rooms had windows except for a small rectangular sliding window in the kitchen. All the walls were made of concrete, making every room 100% completely soundproof. Therefore, I cannot hear any noise coming from the outside. I assume the outside world would not be able to hear me scream from the inside. Also, any noise made on the inside has an echo. To enter the suite, I used a side door which had stairs leading down to the kitchen. Next to the kitchen is a living room. The bathroom is on my left, and walking straight ahead brings me to the first bedroom. You enter the bedroom, and on the left side is a door to the second bedroom. For some reason, the second bedroom is bigger than the first bedroom. Now, I'm sure that there are numerous buildings / fire code violations here, but it looks like they just put in this kitchen as a mortgage helper and then marketed the walk-in closet as a second bedroom. I didn't want to report this to the authorities because that would mean I would lose this great deal of a rental and I would be back on Craigslist looking through rental ads. Logically, it makes sense to put my bed in the second bedroom since it was bigger than the first bedroom. The first bedroom will be my office or computer room. Friday. First night. I am exhausted from work and from moving and unpacking. I know the echoes in the room would take some time to get used to. I could hear everything that moved. The light buzzing from my LED monitor. The whirring of the CPU fan in my laptop. The creaking of my chair every time I moved. Sometimes I can even hear my own breathing if I paid attention. The floor is also pretty cold. Even though the room is carpeted, it still chills my feet, and I can feel a cold draft if I don't wear socks. Good thing tomorrow is Saturday, as I get to sleep in. Saturday night, I came home after hanging out with friends at a local nightclub. My ears were making a high-pitched whining sound from all that silence. I can hear every movement that's made as I crash on my bed from exhaustion. I looked at the time on my phone and saw that it was 2 a.m. My stomach made a long growl. I should probably eat something, but I'm more tired than anything else. Sunday, I plan to do nothing but recuperate. I fell fast asleep. Sunday morning, I slept in. Later, I grabbed lunch, caught a matinee movie, ate dinner, and then early bedtime. I woke up. It doesn't feel like morning time. I feel cold. My body still feels exhausted and my stomach makes a long growl. Hungry again? I grabbed my phone. My fingers felt weak. I fumbled with my phone. It was 2 a.m. I felt exactly the same as I did 24 hours ago. I thought I should have recovered by now. I made a deal with myself. If I want to feel better tomorrow after work, I'll have a big dinner and early bedtime. It is my fault for not eating enough during the day. Monday night, I ordered a big takeout dinner and ate it at home. The echoes of every movement in the suite are driving me crazy. However, if I don't make any sound, the high-pitched whining sound returns. I never thought I had tinnitus. Perhaps I should go to a doctor to check it out. I went to sleep early. I woke up. I reached over to my phone. My fingers barely had any strength in them. I checked the time, 2 a.m. again. My stomach now makes a large growl. And hungry? It's cold and I'm tired, but maybe I really should get out of bed and eat something. My legs felt numb. I used my phone as a flashlight. I walked to the computer room. I left all the doors open because I live alone. Some milk and cereal will really hit the spot. I walked towards the door to the living room to find a wall. A wall? What happened to the door? This room should have two doors. I can't find the light switch. I shined my phone to the other side of the room. Oh, there it is. I feel so disoriented. Why is my back starting to hurt? I walked through the door to find myself back in my bedroom. I'm confused. I feel dizzy. I crawled back into bed hungry. I feel like crap. Tuesday morning, I woke up feeling completely drained. I labored through the day at work. I ate my proper meals at proper times and then came home at a reasonable time to sleep early. Even though it is after hours, I should really be at work, but I'm more valuable to the company well rested. Before bedtime, I'm going to be smart. I brought a box of cookies with me to my bedroom in case I got hungry again, and I went to sleep. I woke up. It's very quiet in here. I can hear my own breathing, and I feel like I haven't slept at all. I wonder if it's morning time. I reached for my phone. Shit, it's only 2 a.m. What is wrong with my fingers? My stomach is growling out loud. Where did I put the box of cookies? It's not there. I thought I remember bringing them in. Did I put them? Let's go to the kitchen. My legs feel really weak. I trudge to the computer room and I hit the wall. Again? Where's that door? I waved my phone across the dark computer room. I saw two doors. I came in from this door, so I should go into the other door. I slowly made my way to that door. I looked in, and it's my bedroom. This is starting to make me really angry. My back is starting to really hurt. I can barely walk. I painfully crawled back to bed, hungry and feeling cold. Pulled a blanket over my head. I can hear my own breathing, and it's driving me crazy. Wednesday morning, I called work to say that I was going to be late. I needed a few extra hours of sleep and a huge meal. I got to work, ate, came home, and got ready for bed. This time, I double-checked, and I brought the box of cookies in with me. Also, I'm sleeping with the lights on. I fell asleep. I woke up. Okay, the lights are still on, but is it morning? I wish there was more windows in this place. I feel tired. I'm cold. I pulled the blankets over my head. Where's my phone? Oh gosh, it is 2 a.m. I can hear my own breathing again. This is driving me crazy. I'm going to hold my breath just to hear silence. How can I still hear breathing? How can I still hear someone breathing? Then I realize that the breathing is coming from somewhere in the suite. Oh shit. I slowly pulled the blankets down and peeked around the room. Nothing. Is someone in the computer room? My arms and legs feel numb. I doubt I can do anything, let alone run, if I have to. I accept that whatever's going to happen to me is going to happen, and I slowly pulled the blankets back above my head. My stomach really hurts. I lay in the fetal position, completely motionless. I fell in and out of consciousness. Unknowingly, I fell asleep. Thursday. I woke up. Strength returned to my hands and feet as usual, but I still feel tired. I checked the time on my phone, 8:30 a.m. I looked around the room. Everything looks the same. Nothing's missing. Nothing's changed. I quickly changed to my work clothes and rushed out the door. During lunchtime, I called my landlord and asked if there's anything he can do to dampen the sound in the room. He said he will go out and ask his contractor. Doesn't really matter what his response is anyways, because I want to know something else. I asked him if he knows anything about the history of the rental suite. He pauses for a second and then decided to tell me. My landlord recently purchased the house. Before him was a real estate agent who renovated the house to make it look nicer and added a second kitchen. Before the renovations, the house was rented to a group of monks who used the house as a monastery. The real estate agent had trouble renting the house because there was a rumor that it was haunted. The monks were the only people willing to live there, but they never mentioned any problems. They subsequently moved out because they wanted a bigger place. Previous tenants prior to the monks had all complained about weird noises and feeling weak and sick from staying in the house. Word spread quickly and soon nobody wanted to live in that house. The real estate agent had thought that the monks had exorcised the house. After the departure, he thought it would be a good time to sell the house, so he renovated the place and sold it to my current landlord. Then my current landlord went on to say that the real estate agent had bought the house at an estate sale. The original owner of the house had passed away in the house, but the house had another horrible secret. In the basement was a secret room, which contained the remains of a body. Nobody was able to ID the body, but it looked like the cause of death was starvation. Not sure what my landlord is going to do next. Maybe he should continue as planned and live on the top floor of the property. All I know is I'm moving out.